Hi, I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and this is Toxic Free Talk Radio, where we talk about how to thrive in a toxic world and live toxic free. It's Tuesday, October 27th, 2015. A little bit of overcast here in Clearwater, Florida. I think we might have a little rain, but no thunderstorms. It's coming into winter. We only have thunderstorms in the summer, as you've probably heard if you've been listening to this show. So today, my guest is Joel Hirschberg. He's the co-founder and president of Green Building Supply, and he has been working with green products for building almost as long as I've been doing my toxics work. He opened one of the nation's first green building supply retail stores in 1991, followed by one of the first online green building stores in the country. So he has a lot of information because he's dealing with all kinds of building materials. And so we could either, you know, when we were talking about what he was going to talk about, we talked about how he could either talk about a lot of different products and say practically nothing, or we could just choose one and say a lot to go narrow and deep instead of wide and shallow. And so today we're going to be talking about flooring and how to choose non-toxic flooring, what's toxic about flooring, everything having to do with flooring. And we're going to be talking about it deeply and really get into the subject. Hi, Joel.
Hello.
How are you doing there? And where are you?
I'm doing good. We're in Fairfield, Iowa, and it's cloudy and 50 degrees here. So we're looking forward to a beautiful fall.
Good. That's good. I thought your website said that you were in Texas. Why did I think that? Just because I was wrong?
No idea.
Okay. Yeah, I was just thinking something else. Well, I'm glad to hear that you're in Fairfield, Iowa. It's a beautiful place. I've been to Fairfield, Iowa.
Nice.
Many years ago. Yeah. So tell us how you got interested in working with building products and why non-toxic. Let's start over. Here's a better question. Let's start with, what's the definition of green?
That's a question I ask all of my own customers because it's not an easy one to answer. And everyone has a different opinion. And as you get into green products and non-toxic products, you start to hear all kinds of different things. And I don't have a one-sentence definition. To me, what's most important, I have priorities, and the most important priority is that it's safe. It's completely non-toxic. To me, that's the ultimate definition of green, but it's only one part of it. Of course, the other part is energy efficiency, low carbon footprint, sustainability. These all go to comprise what I consider green. And the products that we sell have various degrees of each. And there's light green, dark green, and a medium green, and I like to think that what we carry is primarily dark green type products, which basically means that there's nothing hazardous in it. That's the greenest it can be if it's ultimately safe.
Well, I agree with that definition, but that's not the common definition that I see. And
no.
I just want, when people hear the word green, it can be a little confusing because it can range anything from what you've just described to like a product that might be used to fill in cracks to have more energy efficiency that's horribly toxic. And yet it can still be green because it's helping making
right.
the home energy efficient. So I just want to make sure that our listeners understand at the outset that your version of green is in agreement with my viewpoint about things needing to not be toxic.
Yeah, it's become obvious that people who buy green products typically fall into two categories, one that want to and those that have to. And the people that have to are the ones that need something that's completely safe. And those that just want to, they do it because it's cool, because it's unique, or that it's something that's, is energy efficient and saves them a little money. But you're right, there's many, many, many products that don't have all of those requirements met. They're just maybe one or two of them. And the goal is to find products that are, you know, that have all of those characteristics. And
I
it's
agree.
A challenge,
yeah.
For sure.
It is. Some years ago, 1980, So I started doing my work I wrote my first book and self-published it in 1982, first published book in 1984. By 1990, the whole green thing was in the environmental movement was just really coming up about having to have products. It actually started around 1987 or so. And so I shifted my work from being focused on toxics to having to include all these other things. And when you go down a list and say, well, is this not toxic, energy efficient, recyclable, you know, you go down the whole list of the green
right.
screen. There are very few products, if any, that actually meet all those requirements. And they're not even designed to meet all those requirements. And you can't even get the information about all those requirements, which is one of the reasons why I pulled back and said the most thing that's most important, both to health and to the environment, is elimination of toxic chemicals. And so that's where I just kind of landed, because
and that's what you do so well, is to educate people on these things and pulling together different people like myself and others who you've had on your network, talk about what is it that makes their products green and, you know, what's happening in the world, so that consumers can learn all the different you know, ins and outs of these things, because often it's very, very challenging for people to do this kind of research. We talk to people who are building new homes and who are remodeling homes every day, and they all, when they call me, the first thing they say is, you know, I'm chemically sensitive, or I'm completely frustrated because I cannot figure this out at all. It's way too complicated. I don't have a PhD in chemistry. Neither do I, by the way. It's just something that you don't know who to trust. And it comes down to trust, because you read stories, you read green labels, you read research articles, and you also, you know, read what manufacturers say about their products. And they're all different. They're all over the map in terms of what is really green. And some of it's greenwashing, and some of it is light green, and some of it's medium green, and some of it's dark green. Where do you draw the line? There isn't any lines that have been drawn that everyone agrees on. So that's why it's up to the consumer to always do their own homework, and they do that by listening to your show.
Thank you. And going to your website. So how did you get interested in, first let's ask the question of how did you get interested in things being green?
Well, in the 80s, my wife and I decided to build a house, and we wanted a natural house with natural materials. Mm-hmm. And in the 80s, the internet was barely coming alive, and the only way to do research was to go there, to talk to people, to actually see things, you know, in person. Mm-hmm. And that's what we had to do. We traveled around the country for five or 6 years before we actually designed our house. And eventually we found enough products that satisfied us, and we built our house. It was a Frank Lloyd Wright style home, built after his first prairie home in 1901. It was a Willits house from Highland Park, Illinois. And it, you know, Frank Lloyd Wright used a lot of natural materials even back in the 1900s. And it was not easy finding these materials. And eventually, once we finally built our house, and we were able to somehow, we built it, you know, on a really tight budget. But our friends and who were building homes at the same time wanted to do similar things. We happened to live in a community where people like to eat organic food and meditate, and they wanted to build with natural materials as well. So we were asked to help them because we had already done the research. So we did, and we did, and we did, and we did, and we kept doing it house after house. And finally, my wife said, you know, we really need to open up a business doing this because there's so much demand for it. So we eventually did. start offering it to people. So it wasn't never, I had another job and I was totally happy.
Wait, but, I need to interrupt you because we need to go to break. And then we can talk more about this when we come back.
Sure.
You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is Joel Hirschberg. He's the co-founder and president of Green Building Supply, and his version of green is that, number one, it must be not toxic. So when we come back, we'll talk more about our subject of today, which is flooring. Stay tuned. Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is Joel Hirschberg. He's the co-founder and president of Green Building Supply in Fairfield, Iowa. But you can also go online at greenbuildingsupply.com. Okay, so go on with your story about how you got interested in this and what happened. How did you get into it?
How we actually started our business wasn't by choice. It was, we were actually forced into it by local people in a community of 10,000. And as a result, we started to offer different products. And one of the things we discovered was that people started calling us and with questions and problems that they had. And we had our own problems with our own house, which forced us to find newer and newer products, and that's what we continue to do today. And what I developed was sort of a I was like everyone else. It was really hard to find information back then. So
yes,
it's even hard. It's much easier now, but still you have to know how to understand it properly. There's currently, you know, SDS sheets available right now, and EPD sheets, environmental product declarations, and there's a lot of information, but you still need to know how to read it. And I learned how to read this. It took me years to finally get through it and figure it out because people were asking me, and I was interested in it, but it wasn't what I had been trained to do, so I had to kind of do it from the ground up and learn about these chemical terms, which is what I help people with every day, and understanding, you know, they call me up with a product and try to figure out what's in it. Because that's one of the most important things, is what's in the product. How do you know what's in it? You go to the MSDS sheet and you read. If you're lucky, they'll tell you something, but most of the time they don't.
And I just want to interject for our listeners who don't know how these work, that the MSDS sheet, material safety data sheet, is only, they're now called safety data sheets, if you see that instead. But they're designed not for consumers. They're designed for folks who are working with these chemicals. And so they only have to, for a long time I thought there must be some big massive list of the chemicals that if these chemicals are in your product that you have to list them on the MSDS. But there isn't. It's just up to the manufacturer to decide which chemicals need to be listed. And so there could be all kinds of other things that you think are toxic that the manufacturer doesn't think that are toxic that are not on the MSDS. And so I use them not to say this is what's in the product, but if the manufacturer thinks that something is toxic enough to list, then you know it's in there. And that would be something that I would probably not want to be exposed to.
Yeah, they're all voluntarily done as well. There's no one who checks these things to make sure they're accurate. Also, if it's not on the Toxic Substance Control Act list, then they're not required by law to list it unless it's a quote-unquote known hazard. And there's just not that many known hazards that are even listed out of the 86,000 chemicals that are out there. So manufacturers can pretty much put on there only the things that they feel are important and liable for, but there's a lot of proprietary ingredients that they don't have to list. If it's a trade secret, they don't have to list it. So that's why when you read, this is the only information consumers really have, and it wasn't even created for consumers. So what you end up doing is you get one of these and you read it, and then you go, okay, now what? You know, I don't understand it, and is it telling me the full story? So really the only way to know is to test for your own sensitivities, to try it out. Well, who's got time to do that? Well, I had time to do that because, you know, back in the early days, there wasn't that much going on, and so we started testing different products to whether they performed well in Iowa weather, which was very challenging, and whether it was safe to breathe? Well, I am not chemically sensitive, but we have lots of friends in this community who are, and they are, we call them yellow canaries. And those people who are very, very sensitive were helping me find products that were safe. In other words, I would find a product and I would test it out myself. If I liked it, great, then I would give it to them and then let them test it out in their own home. And if they liked it, then I knew, boy, if these people like it, then probably everybody else will too. And since then, over the years of selling products to lots and lots of chemically sensitive people, I've learned what is safe and what works. And that's my ultimate way, testing ground. It's not what the government says, because the government has standards that are not that high, as we all know, and they keep changing. They're getting better, but compared to European standards, they're quite a bit lower. And they also, the reason we test products is because we have learned that when you test something yourself and you know from experience what it does, you can talk about it in a much better way. So
right.
I used all the products myself, and that's how I learned about them.
Wow.
And it took a long time to get there.
To be able to say that, to be able to, for somebody who's looking for non-toxic products, to be able, especially building materials, to be able to go someplace and know that the owner has tested all the products, that's pretty unusual.
Yeah, it is. And we even have all of our staff test them, too. The first thing they do when they get here is we just go through hundreds of products and have them use every single one of them in their own home, as well as in our basement where we have a testing kind of ground. I mean, we're not like a underwriter's laboratory, and we don't have that kind of sophisticated equipment where we can actually test, you know, formaldehyde content and VOC content.
Right.
But we have noses, and God gave us noses so that we can smell and know what's good for us. And most people have very good noses, but we've learned that a lot of people don't. Contractors, for one, don't have very good noses.
No, they're all burned out by all those toxic
chemicals. They're burned out. That's right. And so whose nose are you going to trust? So you have to trust your own nose. Your nose knows most of the time. You still like to verify that things are, you know, have been approved, and that's why having green labels are a good thing. But green labels often are not complete either. They have lots of different criteria for what allows them to grant somebody a green label. And then the question is it third party certified or not, or was it somebody's just their statement about it, you know, which manufacturers do all the time. They do what's called puffing, and they say whatever they want to say, and you don't know if it's true or not. So it becomes a great deal of challenge for people to figure out. And so I guess when we come back, we'll talk about how this relates to flooring.
Yes, we will.
Okay.
I have to give you a job on this show. You can be the announcer. We're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is Joel Hirschberg. He's the co-founder and president of Green Building Supply, which is an actual retail store in Fairfield, Iowa, and also online at greenbuildingsupply.com. And we'll be right back. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and my guest today is Joel Hirschberg. He is the co-founder, and I'm not on my page with all my notes here. He is the co-founder and president of Green Building Supply, which is a retail store in Fairfield, Iowa, and also online at greenbuildingsupply.com. I actually was in Fairfield, Iowa many years ago, like maybe 20 years ago, maybe. I think it was maybe before that, because I don't think your store was there then. So it was in the 80s. It was in the 80s. Uh-huh. Maybe that was when you were traveling around.
Right.
Anyway, when I knew that you actually had said in your bio that that your house was built on principles of Vedic architecture and Frank Lloyd Wright.
Mm-hmm.
Did I get that right? And
yeah.
One of the people that I met in Fairfield, Iowa was Tony Lawlor. You probably know him.
Yes, I do.
He has a great book called The Temple in the House, and he probably has other books since then. But I still had it on my shelf, and I have it sitting here on on my desk now, and I'm just thinking about things to do to my house. And I think it's probably good to be reviewing all these things that I know from the past. But anyway, it must be very interesting and exciting to be able to incorporate these principles in building, which is a totally different show. So let's get to flooring.
Yeah. Well,
say hi to Tony.
Yeah, okay. He isn't here anymore, but if I see him, I will. Okay. Anyway, there's a lot to consider and when you're considering installing a new floor or replacing an old floor or tearing out your carpeting and what to put in. It's always the question. Do I go with – there are a lot of things on the market. There's wool carpeting. There's mm-hmm. cork. There's bamboo. There's hardwoods. There's linoleum. And there's vinyl. We don't sell much vinyl because it's PVC-based, but we prefer the natural-type products, which are about as green as you can get on a flooring. Linoleum made by Forbo Marmoleum, if we're allowed to say brand names.
You can say anything you want.
Okay. is one of the greenest products, but so are cork, and so are bamboo, and so are hardwood. And everyone wants us to ask me, well, what's the difference and how are they different? And, there are clearly differences in how they look. And cost-wise, they're all pretty much in the same range of, from like $4 up to about $6, $7, $8. They're all in that kind of general range. But which floor for you to pick, for your house, depends upon a lot of things. The first question about safety is one that we always, that's what we try to knock out of the box right away by letting people know that we've tested our products and that we've sold them to chemically sensitive people for years and years and years. That's how we know they're good. But people often cite, is it CARB 2 compliant, which is the California Resource Board mm-hmm. Phase 2 rules for formaldehyde content. And there are some companies that have claimed that their products are CARB 2, and then it turned out later that they were not. So you can't always trust what the label says. The case in point, I think you probably discussed this on one of your past talks, maybe not, was about lumber liquidators.
Lumber liquidators, yes.
We
haven't talked about it on the show, but I wrote about it in my blog.
Okay. Well, I won't spend any time on it, but suffice it to say that the whole point of it was that they basically said that something was CARB 2, and they have just recently admitted that they were lying and that they filed a guilty charge, filed saying that they were guilty and paid a $10 million fine, and they've got four or five more class action lawsuits to come. But that is only, CARB 2 only deals with formaldehyde. It does not, and that's usually what's in the glues and the adhesives. And most floors have adhesive in them nowadays. The adhesives are used to bind the top layer with the middle layer with the bottom layer of an engineered floor. And an engineered floor has these different components to it, the top layer of cork or bamboo or linoleum, and then the middle layer could be hardwood or softwood or even an MDF, and the bottom layer could also be cork or it could be a hardwood. That kind of composite product has usually something that has to bind it together. And
right.
the use of formaldehyde in the adhesives has been very common everywhere, and especially in China. But in the U.S., they're now switching over to some new types of adhesives that do not contain as much or do not contain urea formaldehyde. They might contain phenyl formaldehyde, which is considered non-toxic.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't just stop at CARB 2 because CARB 2 only deals with formaldehyde. Proposition 65, which is also a California rule, deals more with volatile organic compounds. And the VOCs are what are off-gassing or emitted from the surface or the finish of the floor. So someone might tell you that their product complies, but does it comply with the VOC levels of Proposition 65 or better? Proposition 65 doesn't mean that there's nothing in it. It just means that it has achieved a level that satisfies the government's requirements. And for you as an individual who might not want any smell whatsoever, they might still find something that complies with Proposition 65 not to be suitable. So again, the only way to know is to really test. And usually what we do for testing is that we tell people to buy a sample, take it home, and then isolate it in a room such as a closet or an automobile or something where it's confined and there's no smell, and then let it off-gas for hours and hours and hours, ideally under the sun, because if you let the sun shine through the window of your car, it'll heat up the car, and the heat tends to accelerate the off-gassing. So the emissions of anything that might be in the wood will start to come out and be noticeable, more noticeable than normal, especially in a small space. If you try to do this test in a big space, you'll never get there. You'll never really know for sure. Although we do have people who sleep with their products, you know, they take it home and they put it in their bed, sleep with it. Mm-hmm. And that's one way they know. Other way, there's a lot of other ways, I'm sure, putting it in a glass jar and putting it outside in the sun. But whatever way you use, we really strongly recommend that everyone, especially if you're sensitive, you need to test every single thing you purchase. You really can't rely on.
I completely agree with that.
You can't rely on the government. You can't rely on the labels. You can't rely on the manufacturers. And I tell them they really can't even rely on what I say, because I've done my own testing and we've had a lot of good experience. But still, you may be that one in a thousand who just doesn't like something about it.
Yeah.
So that's why testing is so important. Once you get past the safe part of this, then the next question becomes, you know, what's the situation in your house? How are you going to use this floor? Who's walking on this floor? And what's the condition of your floor? If your subfloor is made out of concrete or if it's made out of wood, that will have a different impact on, or that will make a that will allow you to make a different decision.
I forgot all about the break.
Okay, here comes the break.
Listening to you. It was so interesting what you were saying. Anyway, we have a break. When we come back, we'll hear more about flooring from Joel Hirschberg, who's the co-founder and president of Green Building Supply in Fairfield, Iowa, also online at greenbuildingsupply.com. And we'll be right back. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Windad, and my guest today is Joel Hirschberg. He's the president and co-founder of Green Building Supply in Fairfield, Iowa. And there's a store there, and online you can find him at greenbuildingsupply.com. Okay, go on about flooring.
Okay. We were talking about how there's the first place to start when looking for a green floor is to look at what's in it and what's on it. And those things are usually found in... Most manufacturers will tell you what they think is in it, and but we still think that people should test that on their own. After that, there are a number of things that you need to look at. Is where you're going to be applying this floor? Is it going on a concrete subfloor or a plywood subfloor, or what is your subfloor? Because sometimes it's not level, sometimes it's not dry. There's a lot of conditions that influence what you should buy. In general, floating floors or engineered floors, as they're also often confused, the term is confused back and forth, are very suitable for just about every type of floor. That's because they float. They don't really levitate, but they literally sit on top of the floor. They're not glued down. They're not nailed down. They sit on top of a pad. Usually an eighth of an inch thick, which has a vapor barrier built into it, or not. Sometimes it does, depends upon what your subfloor is. Different parts of the country, people use different things. They have different subfloors, and therefore they may prefer to use a different type of floor. But the question of your subfloor is always the primary, secondary question after health, and that is, you know, do you want to glue it down? Like in Florida, everybody glues their floor down. In other parts of the country, they nail things down. In other parts, they do a lot of floating floors, and floating floors are getting more popular, mainly because they're easy to install, much faster than a nailed down or glued down floor, much less expensive, and a lot of people prefer to do it themselves.
Mm-hmm.
The DIY type product. So they're making floor, almost every type of floor now is almost everything is available in a floating type system. And usually these are come in planks that are, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 inches wide by 3 to 8 feet long. And they click together, they snap together, and they float over your subfloor. And the probably the most critical part of installing floors is the humidity content of your house. A lot of people don't think about it at all. In fact, if you ask someone whether they have a hygrometer, they'll say, "What's a hygrometer?" No one has hygrometers. They have temperature, you know, something that'll sense the temperature, but not the humidity.
Humidity I have a hygrometer.
Do you? Well, that's good.
I do because I live in Florida where it's very, very humid. And when I first moved here, I wanted to know how humid is it?
Well, manufacturers of flooring all have requirements that are very similar. And there's standards within the wood flooring industry for humidity content. It needs to be somewhere between 35 and 55%. And that's really important. If you don't have that, then your warranty for your flooring is usually void.
Wow.
So it's important to have a hygrometer to make sure that you can measure and know what your humidity levels are in your home. If they're too high, then you do something to lower them by using a dehumidifier or turning on the air conditioner. If they're too low, like in the southwest part of the country, then you have to get something to humidify the air. But that is a requirement for all flooring, and it doesn't matter what type you get. So choosing the right floor is a question that really a lot of it has to do subjectively with what you like the looks of, but probably the most after health, the number one question that people ask is, how durable is it? How long? How well will it hold up? And durability is a really kind of a challenging topic to talk about because durability doesn't mean the same thing to everybody. When you ask somebody, what does it mean to be durable? Well, it lasts a long time, or it doesn't scratch so easily, or when my cat or dog puke on the floor, I can clean it up easily. Those mm-hmm. are different. If they accomplish those, they're durable. Well, another definition of durability is repairability. How easy is it to repair?
Mm.
And nowadays, floors in the United States have either polyurethane finishes or aluminum oxide finishes or UV-cured acrylics. And now, most commonly, they're using oils, oil and wax. And oil and wax finishes are becoming very, very popular. In fact, in Europe, 80% of all flooring are oil and waxed. So it's coming to the U.S. big time, and it's going to happen. And it used to be this way, you know, 50, 60, 70 years ago, that's what people used was oil and wax.
Yeah, and they would wax their floors.
Yeah. And they did. And what happened was, back in the 70s, somebody came around pushing polyurethane, saying, hey, this will make your floor more durable. The truth is, it doesn't make your floor more durable. It puts a finish, a plastic coating on your finish that makes it a little easier to clean, and you don't have to maintain it quite as often as you do in oil. But it still scratches. And if a dog or a cat pukes, it'll eventually go through it if it's not cleaned up quickly. So you have to maintain your floor no matter what. It doesn't matter what finish you have. So you can buy a cork or a bamboo or a linoleum or any type of floor, and you still have to maintain it. Even tile and ceramic tile needs to be maintained. So those are some of the considerations. Obviously,
I want to ask you a question because we only have 5 minutes left.
Of course.
Could you just go back over these finishes on the floors again and just give us a little summary of how toxic each of them are?
It's a good – thank you for asking that because polyurethanes typically – we sell polyurethanes, water-based polyurethanes, but a water-based polyurethane doesn't mean that it's non-toxic. It just means it has a water base instead of an oil base.
Right.
And oil-based are toxic primarily because of the solvents contained in them. Water-based products, polyurethanes, still have solvents in them. they may not be the same solvents, but most of them are still petroleum-based and most of them still off-gas. Right. So just because something has one type of a finish or another doesn't mean that it's safe. Again, got to do your homework. Most products have polyurethane or aluminum oxide, and aluminum oxide is a very, very durable type of finish that's sometimes used by itself, but usually used underneath a polyurethane. They'll use both together with one another. And they typically are used on bamboo floors and hardwood floors nowadays because they're really tough. But you can, if you have a dog, a Labrador Retriever, it can still scratch the floor. So that's why we recommend lighter colored floors, because they show scratches less than dark colored floors. But an oil floor that has an oil wax finish on it, for example, well, before I get to the oil wax, the other type is a UV-cured acrylic. That UV-cured means that in the factory it's cured so that it doesn't off-gas in the residence. The problem with polyurethanes is that they often continue to off-gas in your home for months and months. People always ask, well, how long will it off-gas? It's really hard to tell because humidity plays such a big part in it. And also, if you have your floor resanded and finished in your home by a professional who comes in and sands it and recoats, refinishes it, the finish that they use could off-gas for almost, for years.
Yes.
Some people
so
say
I have to interrupt you and say we only have 2 minutes left, so I want to know about the oil and the wax. How toxic is that?
The oil and wax are not toxic at all. They have they don't have solvent, at least the ones we sell. They don't have anything toxic in them. They don't. It's mainly linseed oil, and linseed oil does smell for several weeks usually, but eventually it goes away, and there's nothing toxic in it.
Good. So, wow, that was a lot of information. So now that we have a minute and a half left, is there anything you'd like to say in closing?
I guess my closing remark would be that anyone who is interested in, installing some new floors needs to really review all the different options besides just the price and besides, what's in it. You have to look at every aspect of it, and there's a lot to know about it. So do your homework and feel free to call us if you have any questions. But it's not as simple as buying clothing. Clothing, you can throw it away if you don't like it, or, it's not such a big expense. Buying flooring is a major investment, and it has to be done. It's something that lasts. Ideally, if it's sustainable, it's something that will go. It lasts as long as your house. You could re-sand it many times.
My house, I live in a house that was built in 1940, so that's 60, 75 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I still have the original hardwood oak floors. And they still look great, and I think I need to oil them and polish them.
And that's the most sustainable way to keep a floor. That's more sustainable than buying a floor, throwing it away in 10 years, and then buying a new one.
Yeah.
So that we really like that approach to flooring. It's the most sustainable way to do it. But it's not for everybody. Sometimes you buy a house and you just can't stand the floor. You want to take it out, put in something new.
Well, thank you so much, Joel. You've given us so much information. And again, Joel's website is greenbuildingsupply.com.
Right.
And you can also go visit him in Fairfield, Iowa, if you're going that way. And I'm sure we're going to talk to you again. It's just great that you have the whole non-toxic perspective that we all want. You're listening to Toxic Free Talk Radio. I'm Deborah Lynn Dadd, and be well.